transformation in trials. Welcome to Transformation in Trials. This is a podcast exploring all things transformational in clinical trials. Nothing is off limits on the show, and we will have guests from the whole spectrum of the clinical trials community. And we're your hosts, Ivana and Sam.
Welcome to another episode of Transformation in Trials. Today in the studio with me, I have Irene Schlosser, who is the founder and CEO of Dynia Health. Hi, Irene.
Hello, Ivana. Nice to meet you. And thank you so much for having me on the podcast today.
So I'm excited about this and excited about our topic, which today will be large language models in clinical research. So to start us off, Irene, could you tell us more? Well, where are we with large language models in clinical research?
Sure, absolutely. So I think, natural language processing as a topic within both medicine as well as clinical trials has been an area that has been very much saturated in terms of the phrasing over the last few years. So everyone has heard NLP, NLP as a flag basically being waved. What NLP has meant both in clinical research as well as in globally has changed quite significantly over the years. And so I think over the past decade, where I like to split it into is basically from the invention of transformers in 2017 and either pre or post that event. So I think healthcare more broadly has invested a lot of effort, time, and resources into what are called more named entity recognition based type models. And we like to compare these types of models to like a dog hearing its name. So if you're thinking about a patient note that it's reading, it goes blah, 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 prostate cancer, blah, 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 prostate cancer. So is very good at picking up on key words and key entities, hence the title named entity recognition, but is not able to draw conclusions and inherently reason as a true type of AI would. And so the traditional way of developing NLP in both healthcare as well as, more specifically in clinical research has been to build out basically data dictionaries and data mappings for specific meanings, which was an immense amount of work on clinicians, researchers. You have all of these standardization of data models that have been used over the past few decades to try and make sense out of information that is recorded in unstructured free text. And to be quite honest, where we are today is the healthcare industry is still using those types of models. There have been an immense amount of investments. There's a little bit of difficulty, let's say, drowning the baby in the bathtub and replacing what is at a technological level currently obsolete. And, this might be a provocative statement, but with large language models and what that has presented in the healthcare space is an opportunity to really change the way things are done. And the only limitation being the computing power, as well as the talent and expertise to train these models and focus on specializing them for various use cases. So I know, we've seen some early successes, for example, like a bridge, which generates text. We are very clearly defining, and I think the industry is starting to define certain tasks uniquely. So there are some large language models that are very good at answering USMLE multiple choice questions. There are other language models that are very good at generating physician notes. We've been particularly focused at Dynia Health with understanding and drawing conclusions with the medical accuracy that a human would have while reading an electronic medical record. And so the way you train the models and the data upon which you train the models is still something that is a wild west, let's say, for healthcare. I don't think that there has been any standardization that we've seen across the board. I think that the main decision makers have not yet had the degree of catching up to where big tech is and AI research is to understand really, how to connect the dots with what is otherwise cutting edge research on the clinical side. So that's where I think we are today.
That's where we are. Well, what are some of the biggest wins we've seen lately in this space? Where have these models been applied and make a difference today?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think in drug discovery, that's been quite useful in the fact that models are being deployed to read through research and publications. I think there are a number of use cases on generating notes or generating, let's say, EMR, electronic medical records. And so that has shown some early successes. I think on the natural language understanding side, we're still quite early. And that's why personally, as our company, that's why we're focused on that, because we saw that as a very unique opportunity. And I think that in terms of reading through medical literature, that's really where the successes next will come out, because I know of a few models that are being focused in on that space. And then I think really the bottleneck to achieving further milestones will be around computing power and the availability of GPU to these larger institutions.
That makes sense. You recently went to the Scope Summit.
I did. Got back yesterday.
Well, very recently. I would be curious to learn, like, based on what you are currently doing and what you saw other companies also doing, where are we going this year?
That's a great question. So I was actually, I gave a talk with John Chellico, who's the CMIO of Common Spirit Healthcare System and was formerly the CIO of Northwell Health. And our main focus was around how within clinical research and specifically real-world data or real-world evidence-based studies, researchers could partner with healthcare systems and what are the roadblocks to that. And I think that's a very unique opportunity that has a lot of red tape involved. And it's, for us, it's been about understanding what are the priorities of the healthcare systems and what are the worries. And so just to highlight a few of these points, the first thing is around data privacy and the IP value of the data. The healthcare systems do not want the data often flowing out of their healthcare system computing environment or firewalls. They fear the privacy from a PHI perspective. They also fear IP leakage because they view the EMR data as a value provider within the space. And so I think number one has been I think the next phase will be an effort to build solutions that fit within their firewall. And it's a shift away from the historical model of data mining and a shift towards AI as a service or providing a service to solve a specific problem. That's how we've been addressing it, and just given input from various advisors who we work with quite closely that are on the healthcare system side and the private provider side. We've been narrowing down on how to standardize those processes so that it's not, a unique deployment every time we get to a new healthcare system. And I think that's something that will likely be a number two point on what's next to come, which is a standardization of deployment. So right now, just as an example with regards to cybersecurity, we get to one healthcare system and they say, oh, thank God you guys don't do, you don't require us to do SAML SSO. And then we get to another one that says, that's absolutely our protocol requirement. You're not doing anything here without that. And so I think everyone's been having different standard operating procedures as just what their previous legacy systems entailed. And so I would expect a standardization of deployment processes and IT integration to happen over the next year. So that's number two. And then, another a big trend and focus area is around computing power and the availability of healthcare systems to be able to run AI systems. So I think, I usually like to say, if there's no GPU, there's no AI. And there are a lot of groups waving AI flags, and there's not a lot of GPU available. So, we had bought a few clusters of NVIDIA A100s before, Elon Musk cleared out the market. But the lag time, even with cloud providers, is months. And for a healthcare system to purchase clusters of GPU, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of machines, as well as then having the talent and resources and housing facility, let's call it data centers, to store them, or they're making a shift to cloud. And so I think the last point with this is going to be the next stage of advancements for how healthcare systems interact with data solutions, and whether they are on-prem, which they've historically been. Many of them are moving into hybrid environments now with cloud. And in the future, as that becomes likely almost exclusively cloud, what's the availability of GPU? I don't think that, you know, if you have a group like Microsoft that's partnering very closely with OpenAI, you know, there's GPU being deployed for training new models on the big tech side. And so it's going to be an interesting dynamic with whether there is going to be availability of computing power for running inference, of actually running and solving the tools.
I love that it's such a tangible limit to how quickly we can move on AI, the amount of actual computing power. That is mind-boggling to mm-hmm. me. You mentioned that Elon Musk cleaned the market for GPUs. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, sure. He spent about $300 million on GPUs and set the supply and demand tipping scale into a little bit of mayhem. So I think, you know, NVIDIA's been manufacturing these as fast as they can. And, you know, that's a whole nother industry. But the problem is global. And I think that, you know, they produce more and then everyone tries to buy them up. But they've been mainly on the big tech side. So most of the people that are directly training these large language models have not been in healthcare, and they've not been in clinical research. They've been in big tech. And so I think that's a stark difference, going back to your question around what other vendors are thinking about. And you know, what we saw at the Scope conference, you know, there's a new name actually for what the previous NLP was, which is, I think it's called precision data mapping. But it's not, you know, large language models. And so I think there's a few qualifying points of understanding whether a group has trained an LLM in-house, whether they're kind of just repurposing a GPT-4 API, and what that looks like. It comes out with architectural planning. And so, you know, and as well as answering and the ability to answer questions as to how models were trained, if they have been trained. I think otherwise in healthcare, there are a number of institutions that are training models in a more academic setting, either with directly with researchers, you know, in a medical center, but it's not necessarily being deployed as part of a commercial end-to-end deployment.
Yeah, I want to kind of look back to the standardizing the deployment piece of AI. Mm-hmm. What can be standardized?
That's a great question. So, I think the method of interacting with a system, and where the data sits and how the data is used. I think that there have been too many efforts in the past to try and just squeeze data out and then sell it and repurpose it in, you know, structured form and de-identified, et cetera. We're looking at a new industry for what data even means. So, you know, if I'm looking at a patient population of EMRs and I'm asking how many patients took a biologic, that's not a raw data point. That's an insight. Yes. And so the insight and the conclusions are being drawn from that can be taken out of a healthcare system environment without necessarily moving the raw EMR data out. And so I think a standardization around what is classified as data, what is classified as insights, what is classified as IP in these engagements is something that will make any process and you know, educating the right parties and legal much easier across the board. And I think that, you know, there does need to be an understanding from the healthcare system side that unless they are investing multiple seven figures into companies that are doing this on a commercial level. You know, they're not the value add here is the training of the models, and you don't necessarily need to do it on EMR data. In fact, I would argue that in many use cases for large language models, just training it on EMR data is not really beneficial. You know, we view our AI training as like a doctor getting their MD degree. You wouldn't want an MD having read 5 million EMRs. And so, you know, we can talk about a few ways of how models are trained, but I think standardization of understanding what is X and what is Y is something that will be a first step for healthcare systems. And that can come through either, you know, I've heard discussions around kind of like standardization of performance benchmarking and how AI models can add value, justifications and explainability, auditability, et cetera. So that's one area. The second is around deployment in actual machines. And I think that's a little bit more difficult to standardize because some groups have their own, you know, high performance computing environment set up. Others are working with cloud. Some have both options and are trying to compare, you know, what gets done with others. You know, we've set up like VPN tunnels. And so the method of how an external vendor can access the information they need and under obviously a business associate agreement to provide those services to the healthcare system is something that is still a little bit up to each institution themselves. We particularly have worked with what each institution has preferred, and they've often had different preferences as to how that works and where the machines sit and whether it's cloud or whether it's in their premise, et cetera. And also how the EMR data moves from one part of their institution to another and the frequency. You know, whether it is like if it's an Epic EMR system, whether it's Kaboodle APIs, whether it's HL7, and the ease of use around the format of the EMR data that's being moved from one spot to the sandbox environment of another.
And that makes sense. I like the analogy of that's what can be standardized is almost like the onboarding of AI, the training and education of it.
That's a great way to summarize it. That's exactly right.
I also want to look back to AI as a service in general. Is it currently delivered as a service, or what is it that will differ once AI becomes a service?
That's a great question. We've been selling it as AI as a service. And so I think it depends on the use case and how, you know, different models have been deployed and if it's being provided as a service, meaning it's commercially contracted to provide X, Y, and Z. I think that, you know, other than like the abridges of the world, I think that the majority of AI is being deployed right now in a building process. And so everyone, you know, you keep hearing the term co-development, co-development, co-development. Well, do we need to co-develop, or are our models already, or is the model for this purpose already performing at above 95% accuracy and it's ready for commercial use end to end? And so I think that's really the question that will start to, you know, come up is that, you know, once a model's already trained and it's retrained and it's improved upon and it's performing and benchmarked against human board certified physicians, do we need to continue to have co-development opportunities, or is that moving out of the academic phase and into commercial setups? And I think that also goes back to the education and kind of development of the knowledge base of decision makers in the space. But for us, you know, I think there's a specific cutoff. I would say the majority of the industry is still in the development phase. I think, you know, ChatGPT's very public announcement kind of in the end of 2022 really kickstarted the industry into thinking, oh, okay, now we understand what AI is.
Yeah.
Whereas before, you know, you had a lot of groups that were kind of tagging on AI to everything. But when you went and we would actually go through just so we know who we're working with or who we're working, you know, in in a more comparable environment to from a business model perspective, we would go through their LinkedIns and count how many people they had with AI research experience, whether they had publications, how many physicians they had, whether they were annotating or training the AI models, and whether they just had, you know, 500 people that had a title of chart abstractor. They've got 500 people somewhere that have a title of chart abstractor. It's not AI.
Yeah. No, absolutely. That's a very nice, specific way to put it.
And I kind of like to like the hamster wheel inside the box. Yeah. So if it's a box that's being called AI and you open it up and there's a hamster just running its feet, it's not a robot. It's a human.
At that point. The Mechanical Turk. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Great.
I want to go back to what you said earlier about the medical accuracy of your model. I am curious, how did you achieve medical accuracy?
That's a great question. So firstly, cleanliness and robustness of training data and information is quite important. So I think I touched upon how, you know, the first stage where we call it pre-adaptation, it's basically like a continual pre-training of the model is done with a knowledge base. And that, you know, we spent probably almost a year cleaning a medical text set for a knowledge base, whether it's textbooks, publications, and just building on that knowledge base. So that's why we like to compare it to like a physician getting their MD degree. It's literally they're trained on a knowledge base. And then the fine tuning for us is actually done with annotated cases by our in-house physician team. So we've got full-time physicians that have cranked out over 25,000 cases. And that is quite competitive for making the model be very specialized. And actually, we like to compare the fine-tuning to like doing its residency, where it's specialized on performing specific tasks for specific disease and therapeutic areas. So we had full-time physicians that were training, well, basically providing ground truth annotations to reading an EMR, asking and generating questions that were relevant for the clinical research areas we were focused on, and then providing a ground truth answer and a justification for that answer. And when that method, we trained our model to be able to explain itself. So it has to pinpoint back to the part of the medical record that led it to derive the conclusion that it derived. And so those ground truths, let's call it annotations from the physician team, is what's also used to benchmark a certain subset of those cases are also used to benchmark our performance against human physicians versus the model. So yeah, that's how we did that. Now, that being said, there isn't just, you know, a point blank type of solution to solve for, or let's say question to solve for. There's also we have varying complexities that we will assess the performance against. So the most complex types of questions are things that have to do with orders of events. So let's say, you know, we're looking for a patient who is a non-smoker. And the, you know, in let's say it wasn't necessarily, and, you know, assuming in this case, just for the simplicity of the example, it's not referenced in a structured data point as smoker and non-smoker. And if we were trying to determine whether they were a non-smoker by their notes, let's say today the physician wrote a note and said the patient quit smoking 1 month before their surgery last year. Then we have to create a chain of thought, literally, to go back last year and see when they had the surgery, what surgery happened. And then the date of that and the month prior was when they quit smoking. And so that chain of thought is not something that traditionally large language models are even designed to solve for. So that's an entirely different level of complexity that, you know, my team has been quite focused on solving, but it's very common in medicine. So medicine often has chains of events that have occurred throughout a patient's history, and those would otherwise form a longitudinal picture if someone was reading and deducing certain conclusions at each point in time. That's what LLMs today are not otherwise designed, built, or capable for solving.
Yeah, that makes sense. Also an interesting journey. I'm curious about your journey into this space, Irene. How did you end up working with large language models in healthcare?
Yeah, that's a great question. I want to say it starts from birth. I was born into a medical family. My entire family is comprised of physicians. I grew up in the space. I was digitizing my father's patient records as a high school job, with manila folders.
Oh, that's awesome. And,
having to pick out which patients were deceased, which patients were inactive, et cetera. So the easy answer is I've been around the space my whole life. I was majoring in biochemistry to also follow into the family business. When I decided that I was, and not to discredit the difficulty, but I was bored with the routine standard of care of after going through this intense process of, going through medicine and residencies and exams and board exams one after another. Then, I was shadowing and doing clinical rotations with family friends and kept seeing that, that most of the days were very similar routine standard of cares, which is great for the patient, but there wasn't enough of what I was excited about, which was solving a new problem. And I'm not a big fan of routine on a daily basis. So at the time, I was a college kid, did some applications, fell into investment banking for a couple years. That was an incredible experience because I was seeing how at scale, very impacting decisions, high impact decisions were being made with a limited set of information. Mm. And a limited set of information meant that they were, making the financial, corporate-wide, industry-impacting decisions from structured data and not taking into account information that was being recorded in free text in many cases. And so that kind of piqued my interest. I started towards the end of my time at Morgan Stanley and M&A, I was working on exclusively technology deals and just fell in love with the tech side. At the time, I only knew how to code in Visual Basic and doing Excel macros. So I had started moonlighting my first business from 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. and realized I needed to learn Python to manage teams of software engineers. So that was really my start. My first business was also very heavily focused on natural language processing, but in its previous, let's call it iteration, which is not really, AI. This is 2014, 2015. So quite early in the technological development of what NLP is. Long story short, I had some early investors in 2018, 2019, who also happened to own hospitals that were getting acquired by a very large group. And their question to me was their curiosity around the value of EMR data from a clinical research perspective. And so what I had been focused on within the NLP space, and as hard as I tried to run from medicine, the kind of perfect storm opportunity presented itself where we and my team and I shifted gears. And I probably spent about a year just diving in with stakeholders and down the rabbit hole of clinical research and real world data and where the inefficiencies were that were being just done by human effort, and just saw this unique opportunity around how most clinical research coordinators, as well as nursing staff, research nurses, and PIs, just spent an immense amount of time doing reviews and reading electronic medical records. And so that process of reading medical records is what we set out to automate. And that's how Diani was born.
Oh, that's amazing. And is that still your focus? Has your focus shifted?
Yep. Nope, that's our focus. So we spent we were born end of 2019. We had our pre-seed funding January 2020, and then suddenly the world changed. And
oh, yeah.
that really was, I would say, a blessing in disguise for us. So we could spend a much larger period of time focus on the focusing on the technology, and came out of the pandemic. And, you know, where I would say the pre-ChatGPT launch, no one really knew. They had trouble in the healthcare space differentiating an LLM based approach versus NLP and what that looked like. And then suddenly, you know, ChatGPT goes live, and you know, within a few months, everyone started to really understand what LLMs meant. And so, I would say, yeah, I mean, we've had a fun year this last year. So,
yeah, I also love that your early experience with patient data was like the very physical experience of files and papers. Like, you've seen the data, you have been in the data.
Yeah. My fingers turned yellow from the manila. Yeah. That was data before it had zeros and ones attached to it. So
exactly. I love that. So like, it makes data very tangible. And mm-hmm. I think it's easier to imagine, well, how else could this look like if you actually understand, well, what did it look like?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And also the pain of, you know, a clinician having to read and understand and just like sit there and study medical records in order to make whatever conclusion they were looking to draw for the patient's care. And that mental process is just what, for me, it just seems so obvious that it just needed to be automated. We needed clinicians focusing their care efforts on the patient and on running the clinical research, and not on just spending time going through EMR. So it takes about 30 minutes or more, depending on the complexity of the patient's disease area, to read through a single medical record. And so even chart abstractors, they can get through about 4,000 EMRs per year. And so when you're looking at the entirety of, you know, hundreds of millions of EMRs, that's just an immense waste of time if you can do that on an AI level with a fraction of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. That has a great potential. Well, which brings us to the question that we always ask, Chris, on this show. And that is, if we gave you the transformation trials magic wand that can change one thing in the life sciences industry, what would you wish to change?
Wow. So I would say, you know, I think this might be a problem that's already getting solved, but an immense amount of GPU in the space would be, can I say two things?
Oh, we'll make an exception. Yes.
Well, one, I would be two things in parallel. One would be just an unlimited amount of computing power, mm-hmm. and two would be physicians who had also been trained in data science and Ooh. And applied mathematics.
I can see how that would be a game changer. Yes. Then we can start talking about like true augmentation of their capabilities if they understand how to interact with data.
Mm-hmm.
Those are great wishes. Well, Irene, if our listeners want to learn more about Dynia Health or about yourself, where can they find you?
Great. So it's on LinkedIn, Irene Schlosser, or on our website. It's www.dyaniahealth, D-Y-A-N-I-A, health.com. And you can also find us on info@dyaniahealth.com for emails.
Oh, awesome. This has been a lovely conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Transformation in Trials. If you have a suggestion for a guest for our show, reach out to Sam Parnell or Ivana Rosendahl on LinkedIn. You can find more episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or in any other player. Remember to subscribe and get the episodes hot off the editor.